Marino didn't do anything right away. My anxiety grew as Bray parked and turned her headlights off. I felt sure she wouldn't wait for Chuck very long, and could already imagine her annoyance. Little nobodies like him didn't dare to keep Deputy Chief Diane Bray waiting. "Is there something I can do for you?" the bartender asked me as he dried off a glass. I continued to peer through the barely open door, wondering what Marino was going to do next. "I'm expecting someone who isn't sure exactly where you're located," I said.
"Just tell him we're next to Michelle's Faceworks," he said as Marino got out of his truck.
I met him in the parking lot and we walked with purpose toward Bray's car. She didn't notice us because she was talking on her portable phone and writing something down. When Marino tapped on her window, she turned to us, startled. Then her face turned hard. She said something else on her portable and ended her call. The window hummed down.
"Deputy Chief Bray, thought that was you," Marino said, as if they were old friends.
He bent down and peered inside her car. Bray was clearly off balance, and one could almost see her calculating thoughts regrouping in her head as she pretended there was nothing unusual about our running into her here. "Good evening," I politely said. "What a pleasant coincidence."
"Kay, what a surprise," she said in a flat voice. "How are you? So you've discovered Richmond's little secret."
"By now I know most of Richmond's little secrets," I said with irony. "There are many of them if you know where to look."
"I stay away from red meat as much as possible," Bray switched conversational lanes. "But their fish is very good."
"That's like going to a whorehouse and playing solitaire," Marino remarked.
Bray ignored him and tried to stare me down with no success. I'd learned from many years of warring with bad employees, dishonest defense attorneys, and ruthless politicians that if I stared between a person's eyes, he didn't know I wasn't in fact staring into his eyes, and I could keep up the intimidation all day.
"I'm eating dinner here," she said, as if she were distracted and in a hurry.
"We'll wait until your guest shows up," Marino said. "Sure don't want you sitting alone out here in the dark or being bothered inside. Truth is, Deputy Chief Bray, you shouldn't be roaming around without security, as recognizable as you've gotten to be since you moved here. You've kind of gotten to be a celebrity, you know."
"I'm not meeting anyone," she said, irritation honing her tone.
"We've never had a woman so high up in the department, especially one so attractive and so loved by the media." Marino wouldn't shut up.
She collected her pocketbook and mail off the seat, her cold anger palpable.
"Now, if you'll please excuse me,"
she said it as an order.
"It's not going to be easy to get a table tonight," I let her know as she opened her door.
"Unless you have a reservation," I added, implying I knew damn well she didn't. Bray's poise and self-confidence slipped just enough to unmask the evil coiling within. Her eyes struck at me, then revealed nothing as she climbed out of the car and Marino blocked her way. She couldn't get past him without ducking around him and brushing against him, and her enormous ego would never allow that. She was almost pinned against the door of her shiny new car. It didn't escape my notice that she was dressed in corduroys, running shoes, and a Richmond Police Department jacket. Vain woman that she was, she would never show up in a fine restaurant dressed like that.
"Excuse me," she said loudly to Marino.
"Oh, gee, I'm sorry," he gushed, stepping to one side.
I chose my next words carefully. I could not directly accuse her, but I intended to make sure she knew she'd gotten away with nothing, and if she persisted in her ambushes, she would lose and she would pay.
"You're an investigator," I thoughtfully said to her. "Maybe you can tell me your opinion on how someone might have gotten hold of my password and emailed messages impersonating me. And then someone, most likely the same person, started an asinine, lobotomized chat room on the internet called Dear Dr. K."
"How awful. I'm sorry, I can't help you. Computers are not my specialty," she said with a smile. Her eyes were dark holes, her teeth flashing like steel blades in the glow of sodium lights.
"All I can suggest is you look at the people closest to you, perhaps someone disgruntled, a friend you've fallen out with," she continued her act. "I really have no idea, but I would expect it's someone with a link to you."
I've heard your niece is an expert in computers. Maybe she could help you. Her mention of Lucy infuriated me. I've been wanting to talk to her, Bray said as a by-the-way. You know we're implementing CompStat and need a computer expert. CompStat, or computer-driven statistics, was a new model of enlightened, technologically advanced policing devised by the New York Police Department. Computer experts would be needed for it, but to suggest a project like that for someone with Lucy's skills and experience was an insult. You might pass this along to her when you talk next, Bray added. Marino's rage was boiling like water in a pot. We really should sit down sometime, Kay, and let me tell you about some of my experiences in Washington, she said, as if I had never worked anywhere but in a small town. You can't even begin to know the things people will try to bring you down, especially women against the women. Sabotage in the workplace. I've seen the best topple.
I'm sure you have, I said.
She locked her car door and said, Just so you know, you don't need a reservation to sit at the bar. That's where I usually eat anyway. They're famous for their steak fromage, but I recommend you try the lobster, Kay. And you, Captain Marino, would love their onion rings. I hear they're to die for. We watched her walk off.
Fucking bitch, Marino said.
Let's get out of here, I said.
Yeah. Last thing I want to do is eat anywhere near poison like that. I ain't even hungry.
That won't last. We climbed into his truck, and I sank beneath the heavy depression that held me down like tar. I wanted to find some victory, some ray of optimism in what had just transpired, but I couldn't. I felt defeated. Worse, I felt foolish.
Want a cigarette? Marino asked inside the dark cab as he punched in the lighter.
Why not? I muttered. I'm going to stop again pretty soon. He handed one to me and lit his. He gave me the lighter. He kept glancing over at me, knowing how I felt.
I still think it was a good thing we done, he said. I bet she's in that restaurant belting down whiskeys because we got her good.
We didn't get her good, I replied, squinting at the lights of cars passing by. With her, I'm afraid the only silver bullet is prevention. We have to guard against further damage by not only anticipating, but also following up on everything we do. I opened the window several inches, cold air touching my hair. I blew out smoke.
No show Chuck, I commented.
Oh, he showed up. You just didn't see him because he saw us first and hightailed it out of there.
You sure?
I saw his piece of shit Miata turning into the road leading to the shopping center, and then about halfway to the parking lot it suddenly did a U-turn and got the hell out of Dodge. And this was at the exact time Bray said something else on her portable after she saw us outside her car.
Chuck's a direct conduit from me to her, I said. She may as well have a key to my office.
Hell, maybe she does, he said. But Doc, you just leave Chucky boy to me.
Now that scares me, I said. Please don't go doing something reckless, Marino. He does work for me, after all. I don't need any other problems.
My point exactly. You don't need any more problems.
He dropped me off at the office and waited until I got into my car. I followed him out of the parking lot, and he went his way, and I went mine. 19. The tiny moon eyes from the dead man's skin glowed in my mind. They looked out from that deep, off-limits place where I stored my fears, which were many and of a kind not felt by anyone else I knew. Wind shook bare trees, and clouds streamed like banners across the sky as a cold front rushed in. I had heard on the news the temperature might dip into the 20s tonight, which seemed impossible after weeks that felt like fall. It seemed everything was out of balance and abnormal in my life. Lucy wasn't Lucy, so I couldn't call her and she wasn't speaking to me. Marino was working a homicide, even though he wasn't a detective anymore, and Benton was gone. And everywhere I looked for him, I found an empty frame. I still waited for his car to drive up, for the phone to ring, for the sound of his voice, because it was too soon for my heart to accept what my brain knew. I turned off the downtown expressway onto Carey Street, and as I drove past a shopping center and the Venice restaurant, I became aware of a car behind me.
It was driving very slowly and too far away for me to tell anything about the person behind the wheel. Instinct told me to slow down, and when I did, so did the car. I turned right on Carey Street, and the car stayed with me. When I took a left into Windsor Farms, there it was, maintaining the same safe distance. I didn't want to get any deeper into this neighborhood because the roads were winding and narrow and dark. There were many cul-de-sacs. I took a right on Dover and dialed Marino's number as the car turned right too, and my fear grew. "Marino," I said out loud to nobody there. "Be home, Marino." I ended the call and tried again. "Marino, goddammit, be home," I said to the hands-free phone in the dashboard, as Marino's clunky cordless phone inside his house rang and rang. He probably had it parked by the TV as usual. Half the time he couldn't find it because he didn't return it to its base. Maybe he wasn't home yet. "What?" His loud voice surprised me. "It's me. Goddamn motherfucking son of a bitch! If I hit my knee on that goddamn table one more time, Marino, listen to me. Once more, and it's out in the yard, and I'm gonna smash the shit out of it with a hammer. Right in the fucking kneecap. I can't see the fucking thing, 'cause it's glass, and guess who said it would look so nice there?" "Calm down," I exclaimed, watching the car in my mirror. "I've had 3 beers and I'm hungry and tired as hell. What?" he asked. "There's someone following me." I turned right on Windsor Way, heading back to Carey Street. I drove at a normal speed. I did nothing out of the ordinary except not head for my house. "What do you mean someone's following you?" Marino asked. "What the hell do you think I mean?" I said, as my anxiety heated up more. "Then head this way right now," he said. "Get out of that dark neighborhood of yours." "I am." "Can you see a plate number or anything?" "No, he's too far behind me. It seems he's deliberately staying far enough behind me so I can't read the tag or see his face." I got back on the expressway, heading to the Powhite Parkway, and the person tailing me apparently gave up and turned off somewhere. Lights of moving cars and trucks and the iridescent paint on signs were confusing, and my heart was beating hard. The half-moon slipped in and out of clouds like a button, and gusts of wind rushed the side of the car like linebackers. I dialed my answering service at home. I had 3 hang-ups, and a 4th message that was a slap in the face. "Chief Bray here," it began. "So nice to run into you at Buckhead's. I have a few policy and procedural issues to discuss with you, managing crime scenes and evidence and so on. I've been meaning to discuss them with you, Kay." The sound of my first name coming out of her mouth infuriated me. "Maybe we can have lunch in the next few days," her recorded voice went on. "A nice private lunch at the Commonwealth Club?" My home phone number was unlisted, and I was very careful who I gave it to, but it was no riddle how she'd gotten it. My staff, including Ruffin, had to be able to reach me at home. "In case you haven't heard," Bray's message went on, "Al Carson resigned today. You remember him, I'm sure. Deputy Chief of Investigations. A real shame. Major Inman will be acting Deputy Chief." I slowed at a toll booth and tossed a token into the bin. I moved on, and a beat-up Toyota full of teenaged boys stared boldly at me as they passed. One of them mouthed, "Motherfucker," for no apparent reason. I concentrated on the road as I thought about what Wagner had said. Someone was pressuring Representative Connors to push legislation that would transfer my office out of Health and Human Services and into Public Safety, where the police department would have more control over me. Women could not join the prestigious Commonwealth Club, where half of the major business deals and politics affecting Virginia were made by male power brokers with old family names. Rumor had it that these men, many of whom I knew, congregated around the indoor swimming pool, most of them naked. They bartered and pontificated in the locker room, a forum where women weren't allowed. Since Bray couldn't walk through the door of that ivy-draped 18th-century club unless she was the guest of a member, my suspicions about her ultimate ambition were virtually confirmed. Bray was lobbying members of the General Assembly and powerful businessmen.
She wanted to be the Secretary of Public Safety and have my office transferred to that secretariat. Then she could fire me herself. I reached Midlothian Turnpike and could see Marino's house long before I got near it. His gaudy, outrageous Christmas decorations, including some 300,000 lights, glowed above the horizon like an amusement park. All one had to do was follow the steady traffic heading that way, because Marino's house had risen to number one on Richmond's annual Christmas tacky tour. People couldn't resist coming to see what was truly an amazing sight. Lights of every color were sprinkled in trees like neon candy. Santas, snowmen, trains, and toy soldiers glowed in the yard, and gingerbread cookies held hands. Candy canes brightly stood sentry along his sidewalk, and lights spelled out season's greetings and think snow on the roof. In a part of the yard where scarcely a flower grew and grass was patchy brown all year long, Marino had planted happy electric gardens. There was the North Pole, where Mr. and Mrs. Claus seemed to be discussing plans, and nearby choir boys sang, while flamingos perched on the chimney and ice skaters twirled around a spruce. A white limousine crept past, followed by a church van, as I hurried up his front steps, feeling irradiated and trapped in a spotlight. "Every time I see this, it confirms you've lost your mind," I said when Marino came to the door, and I quickly ducked away from curious eyes. "Last year was bad enough." "I'm up to 3 fuse boxes," he proudly announced. He was in jeans and socks and a red flannel shirt with the tail hanging out. "Least I can come home and something makes me happy," he said. "Pizza's on the way. I got bourbon if you want some."
"What pizza?"
"One I ordered. Everything on it. My treat. Papa John's don't even need my address anymore. They just follow the lights."
"What about hot decaffeinated tea?" I said, quite certain he would have no such thing.
"You got to be kidding," he replied.
I looked around as we walked through the living room into his small kitchen. Of course, he had decorated the inside of his house, too. The tree was up and flickering by the fireplace. Presents, almost all of them fake, were piled high, and every window was framed by strands of red jalapeno lights.
"Bray called me," I said, filling the tea kettle with water. "Someone gave her my home number."
"Guess who?"
He yanked open the refrigerator door, his good mood retreating fast.
"And I think I might know why that happened."
I set the kettle on the stove and turned on the burner. Lights flickered. "Deputy Chief Carson resigned today."
"Or supposedly resigned," I said.
Marino popped open a beer. If he was aware of this news, he didn't show it.
"Did you know he quit?" I asked.
"I don't know nothing anymore."
"Apparently Major Inman is the acting deputy chief."
"Oh, of course," Marino loudly said. "And you know why? Because there are 2 majors, one in uniform, the other in investigations. So, of course, Bray sends her boy from uniform in there to take over investigations."
He'd finished the beer in what seemed 3 gulps. He violently crushed the can and threw it into the trash. He missed, and the can clattered across the floor.
"You got any idea what that means?" he said. "Well, let me tell you. It means Bray's now running uniform and investigations, meaning she's running the entire fucking department and probably controlling the entire budget, too. And the chief's her biggest fan because she makes him look good. Tell me how this woman comes in and not even 3 months later can do all that."
"Clearly she's got connections. Probably did before she took this job. And I don't mean just to the chief."
"Well, to who, then?"
"Marino, it could be anyone. It doesn't matter at this point. It's too late for it to matter. Now we have to contend with her, not the chief. Her, not the person who might have pulled strings." He popped open another beer, angrily pacing the kitchen.
"Now I know why Carson showed up at the scene," he said. "He knew this was coming. He knows how bad this shit stinks, and maybe he was trying to warn us in his own way or just signing off. His career's over. The end, last crime scene, last everything."
"He's such a good man," I said. "God damn it, Marino. There's got to be something we can do." His phone rang, startling me. The sound of cars on the street out front was a steady rumble of engines.
Marino's continuous tinny Christmas music was playing jingle bells again.
"Bray wants to talk to me about so-called changes she's instigating," I told him.
"Oh, I'm sure she does," he said, his stocking feet patting across linoleum. "And I guess you're just supposed to drop everything when she suddenly wants to have you for lunch, which is what she's gonna do, have you between rye with lots of mustard."
He grabbed the phone.
"What?" he yelled at the poor person on the other end.
Yeah, Marino said, listening. I rummaged in cabinets and found one smashed box of Lipton tea bags.
"I'm here. Why the hell don't you talk to me?" Marino indignantly said into the phone.
He listened, pacing about.
"Now that's a good one," he said. "Hold on a minute. Let me just ask her."
He put his hand over the receiver and asked in a hushed voice,
"Are you sure you're Dr. Scarpetta?"
He got back to the person on the phone.
"She says she was last time she checked,"
and he irritably shoved the receiver my way.
"Yes?" I asked.
"Dr. Scarpetta?" an unfamiliar voice said. "Here?"
"I'm Ted Francisco, ATF field office in Miami."
I froze as if someone were pointing a gun at me.
"Lucy told me Captain Marino might know where you are if we couldn't reach you at home. Can you speak to her?"
"Of course,"
I said, alarmed.
"Aunt Kay?" Her voice came over the line.
"Lucy, what is it?" I said. "Are you all right?"
"I don't know if you heard what happened down here."
"I haven't heard anything,"
I quickly said, as Marino stopped what he was doing and stared at me.
"Our takedown. It didn't go right. Too much to go into, but it went really, really bad. I had to kill two of them. Joe got shot."
"Oh, dear God," I said.
"Please tell me she's all right."
"I don't know," she said, with a steadiness that was completely abnormal. "They have her in Jackson Memorial under some other name, and I can't call her. They've got me in isolation because they're afraid the others will try to find us. Retribution. The cartel. All I know is she was bleeding from her head and leg, unconscious when the ambulance got her."
Lucy registered no emotion at all. She sounded like one of the robots, or artificial intelligence computers, she had programmed at earlier times in her career.
"I'll get..."
I started to say when Agent Francisco suddenly was back on the line.
"I know you're going to hear about this on the news, Dr. Scarpetta, and I wanted to make sure you knew, especially that Lucy's not hurt."
"Maybe not physically," I said.
"I want to tell you exactly what will happen next."
"What will happen next," I interrupted him, "is I'm flying down there immediately. I'll get a private plane if I have to."
"I'd like to ask you not to do that," he said. "Let me explain. This is a very, very vicious group, and Lucy and Joe know far too much about them, about who some of them are and how they do business. Within hours of the shooting, we sent a Miami-Dade bomb squad to Lucy and Joe's respective undercover residences, and our bomb squad detected pipe bombs wired under each of their cars."
I pulled a chair out from Marino's kitchen table and sat down. I felt weak all over. My vision was blurred.
"Are you there?" he said.
"Yes, yes."
"What's happening right now, Dr. Scarpetta, is Miami-Dade is working the cases, just as you might expect, and normally we'd have a shooting review team on its way in addition to peer support guys, agents who've been involved in critical incidents and are trained to work with other agents going through things like this. But because of the threat level, we're sending Lucy north, to D.C., to wherever she's safe."
"Thank you for taking such good care of her. God bless you,"
I said, in a voice that didn't sound like me. "Look, I know how you feel," Agent Francisco said. "I promise you I do. I was at Waco."
"Thank you," I said again. "What will DEA do with Joe?"
"Transfer to another hospital a million miles away from here as soon as we can."
"What about MCV?"
I asked. "I'm not familiar. Her family lives in Richmond, as you may know. But more to the point, MCV is excellent, and I'm on the faculty," I said. "If you get her here, I'll personally make sure she's well taken care of." He hesitated, then said, "Thank you. I will take that under advisement and discuss it with her supervisor."
When he hung up, I stood staring at the phone.
What? Marino asked.
The takedown went haywire. Lucy shot two people to death.
Was it a good shooting? He cut me off.
No shooting is good. God damn it, Doc! You know what I mean. Was it justified? Don't tell me she fucking shot two agents by accident.
No, of course not. Joe was shot. I'm not sure of her condition.
Fuck! He exclaimed, pounding his fist so hard on the kitchen counter dishes rattled in the drain board. Lucy just had to go slug it out with somebody, didn't she? They shouldn't have even had her in a takedown like this. I could have told them that. She's just been waiting to shoot the shit out of someone, to go in like a damn cowboy with pistols blazing, to pay back everyone she hates in life.
Marino, stop it.
You saw what she was like at your house the other night, he railed on. She's been a damn psycho ever since Benton got killed. There's no payback that's enough. Not even shooting that damn helicopter out of the air and chumming the water with Carrie Gretchen's and Newton Joyce's pieces and parts.
That's enough, I said, exhausted. Please, Marino, this isn't helping anything. Lucy's a professional, and you know that. ATF would never have given her an assignment like this if she weren't. They know her story very well and evaluated and counseled her extensively after what happened to Benton and all the rest of it. In fact, how she handled that entire nightmare only gave them more respect for her as both an agent and a human being. He was silent as he opened a bottle of Jack Daniels. Then he said, "Well, you and I know she ain't handling it so well."
Lucy has always been able to compartmentalize.
Yeah, and how healthy is that?
I guess we should ask each other that.
But I'm telling you right now, this time she ain't gonna handle it well, Doc, he said, splashing bourbon into a glass and dropping in several ice cubes. She killed two people in the line of duty barely a year ago, and now she's just done it again. Most guys go their entire careers and don't even take a shot at somebody. That's why I'm trying to make you understand it's gonna be viewed differently this time. The big guys in Washington are going to consider that maybe they got a gunslinger on their hands, someone who's a problem.
He handed the drink to me.
I've known cops, agents like that, he said. They always have justifiable reasons for judicial homicide, but if you look hard at it, you begin to get the drift that they subconsciously set things up to go bad. They thrive on it.
Lucy's not like that.
Yeah, she's only been pissed off since the day she was born. And by the way, you ain't going anywhere tonight. You're staying here with me and Father Christmas.
He poured himself a bourbon, too, and we went into his shabby, crowded living room with its crooked lampshades, its dusty, bent Venetian blinds, and the sharp-cornered glass coffee table he blamed on me. He dropped into his recliner chair, which was so old he had repaired splits in the brown naugahyde with duct tape. I remembered the first time I walked into his house. After recovering from the dismay, I realized he was proud of how thoroughly he wore everything out, except for his truck, above-ground pool, and now his Christmas decorations. He caught me staring dismally at his chair as I curled up in a corner of the green corduroy couch I tended to always choose. It might have been missing its whale wherever bodies came in touch with it, but it was cozy.
One day I'll get a new one of these, he said, pushing down the lever on the side of the chair and sliding the footrest out.
He wiggled his stocking feet as if his toes were cramped and flicked on TV. I was surprised when he changed the channel to 21, the Arts and Entertainments Network. I didn't know you watched Biography, I said.
Oh, yeah. And the real-life cops shows they usually got on. This may sound like I've been sniffing glue, but does it strike you how everything in the world's gone to hell ever since Bray came to town?
I'm sure it would strike you that way after what she's been doing to you.
Huh. And she's not been doing the same thing to you? He challenged, sipping his drink. I'm not the only person in this room she's trying to ruin.
I don't think she has the power to cause everything else going on in life, I replied.
Let me just run through the list for you, Doc, and make sure to remember we're talking about a 3-month period, okay? She arrives in Richmond. I get thrown back in uniform. You suddenly have a thief in your office. You have a snitch who breaks into your email and turns you into Dear Appy.
Then this dead guy shows up in a container and Interpol's suddenly in the picture, and now Lucy kills two people, which is convenient for Bray, by the way. Don't forget, she's been all hot and bothered about getting Lucy to sign on with Richmond. And if ATF throws Lucy back like a fish, she's gonna need a job. And oh yeah, now someone's following you.
I watched a young, gorgeous Liberace playing the piano and singing, while a voiceover of a friend talked about what a kind, generous man the musician had been.
"You're not listening to me!"
Marino raised his voice again.
"I'm listening."
He heaved himself up again with an exasperated huff and padded into the kitchen.
"Have we heard anything from Interpol?" I called out as he made a lot of noise tearing open paper and rummaging through the silverware drawer.
"Nothing worth passing on."
The microwave hummed.
"It would be nice if you'd pass it on anyway," I said, annoyed.
Stage lights caught Liberace blowing kisses to his audience, and his sequins flashed like an intense red and gold fireworks display. Marino walked back into the living room with a bowl of ruffled potato chips and a container of some sort of dip.
"The guys at State Police got a computer message back from them within an hour. They just requested more info, that's all."
"That tells us a lot," I said, disappointed.
"That probably means they didn't get a hit on anything significant. The old fracture of the jaw, the unusual accessory cusp of the carabelli, not to mention fingerprints. None of it matched up with anybody wanted or missing."
"Yeah, it's a pisser," he said, his mouth full as he held out the bowl to me.
"No, thanks."
"It's really good. What you do is soften the cream cheese in the microwave first and put in jalapenos. It's a lot better for you than onion dip."
"I'm sure."
"You know, I always liked him."
He pointed a greasy finger at the TV.
"I don't care if he was queer. You gotta admit he had style. If people are gonna pay all that money for records and concert tickets, by God, they ought to get people who don't look and act like some schmo on the street."
"Let me tell you," Marino said with his mouth full, "shootings are a bitch. You get investigated as if you made an attempt on the damn president, and then there's all the counseling and everybody worrying about your mental health so much it makes you crazy."
He threw back bourbon and crunched more chips.
"She's gonna get some time on the bricks," he went on, using cop jargon for involuntary time off. "And Miami detectives are gonna work it like they always work homicides. Got to. And everything will have the hell reviewed out of it."
He looked over at me, wiping his hands on his jeans.
"I know this won't make you feel good, but maybe you're the last person she wants to see right now," he said.
20. There was a rule in our building that any evidence, even something as innocuous as a 10-print card, had to be transported on the service elevator. This was located at the end of a hallway where two cleaning ladies were this minute pushing their carts as I headed to Niles Vander's lab.
"Good morning, Merle. And Beatrice, how are you?" I smiled at them.
Their eyes landed on the towel-covered surgical pan and the paper sheets covering the gurney I was pushing. They'd been around long enough to know that whenever I carried something bagged or pushed something covered, it was nothing they wanted to know about.
"Uh-oh," Merle said.
"Uh-oh is right," Beatrice chimed in.
I pushed the elevator button.
"You going any place special for Christmas, Dr. Scarpetta?"
They could tell by the look on my face that Christmas was a topic I didn't particularly care to talk about.
"You're probably too busy for Christmas," Merle quickly said.
Both women got uncomfortable for the same reason everybody else did when they were reminded of what had happened to Benton.
"I know this time of year gets real busy," Merle awkwardly changed the subject. "All those people drinking on the road, more suicides and people getting mad at each other."
Christmas would be here in about 2 weeks. Fielding was on call that day. I couldn't count how many Christmases I had worn a pager.
"People burning up in fires, too."
"When bad things happen this time of year," I said to them as the elevator doors opened, "we feel them more. That's a lot of it."
"Maybe that's it."
"I don't know about that. Remember that electrical fire?"
The doors shut, and I headed up to the second floor, which had been designed to accommodate tours for citizens and politicians and anyone else interested in our work. All labs were behind big expanses of plate glass, and at first this had seemed odd and uncomfortable to scientists used to working in secret behind cinder block walls. By now, nobody cared. Examiners tested trigger pulls and worked with bloodstains, fingerprints, and fibers without paying too much attention to who was on the other side of the glass, which at this moment included me pushing my gurney past. Niels Vander's world was a large space of countertops, with all sorts of unusual technical instruments and jerry-rigged contraptions scattered all over the place. Against one wall were wooden cabinets with glass doors, and these Vander had turned into glue chambers, using clothesline and clothespins to hold up objects exposed to the superglue fumes generated by a hot plate. In the past, scientists and police had very little success in lifting prints from non-porous objects such as plastic bags, electrical tape, and leather. Then, quite by accident, it was discovered that the fumes from superglue adhere to ridge detail, much as traditional dusting powder does, and out pops a white latent print. In a corner was another glue chamber called a Civac II that could accommodate larger objects such as a shotgun or rifle or car bumper, or theoretically even an entire body. Humidity chambers raised prints off porous items such as paper or wood that had been treated with ninhydrin. Although Vander sometimes resorted to the quick method of using a household steam iron, and once or twice had scorched the evidence, or so I'd heard. Scattered about were Naderman lights equipped with vacuums to suck up fumes and residues from drug baggies. Other rooms in Vander's domain housed the automatic fingerprints identification system known as APHIS, and dark rooms for digital audio and video enhancement. He oversaw the photo lab, where more than 150 rolls of processed film came off the Speedmaster every day. It took me a while to locate Vander, but I finally caught him in the impression lab, where pizza boxes ingenious cops used to transport plaster casts of tire tracks and footwear prints were neatly stacked in corners, and a door someone had tried to kick in was leaning against a wall. Vander was seated before a computer, comparing footwear impressions on a split screen. I left the gurney outside the door. "You're nice to do this," I said. His pale blue eyes always seemed to be elsewhere, and as usual his lab coat was stained purple from ninhydrin, and a felt-tip pen had bled through one of his pockets. "This is a real good one," he said, tapping the video screen as he got out of his chair. "Guy buys new shoes, and you know how slippery they are if the bottoms are leather? So he gets a knife and slashes them, you know, roughs them up, because he's getting married and doesn't want to slip coming down the aisle. I follow him out of the lab, not really in the mood for anecdotes. Well, he gets burglarized. Shoes, bunch of other clothes and stuff, gone. 2 days later, a woman in his neighborhood is raped. Police find these weird shoe prints at the scene. In fact, there'd been quite a lot of burglaries in that area. We entered the alternate light source lab. Turns out it was this kid, 13. Vander was shaking his head as he flipped on the lights. I just don't know about kids anymore. When I was 13, the worst thing I ever did was shoot a bird with a BB gun. He mounted the Lumalight on a tripod. That's pretty bad in my book, I told him. While I laid out the clothes on white paper under the chemical hood, he plugged in the Lumalight and its fans began to whir. A minute later, he started the source lamp, rotating the intensity knob to full power. He set a pair of protective glasses near me and placed a blue 450 nanometer optical filter over the output lens. We put on our glasses and turned out the lights. The Lumalight cast a blue glow across the floor, and Vander's shadow moved as he did, and nearby jars of dye lit up brilliant yellow and blitz green and red wop. Their dust was a constellation of neon stars scattered throughout the room. You know, we've got these idiots at police departments these days who are getting their own Lumalights and processing their own scenes, Vander's voice sounded in the dark. So they dust with red wop and put the print on a black background, so I have to photograph it with the Lumalight on and reverse the damn print to white. He started with the plastic waste paper basket found inside the container, and was instantly rewarded with the faint ridges of fingerprint smudges, which he dusted with Redwop, its electric red dust drifting through the dark. "Good way to start," I said. "Keep it up, Niels." Vander moved the tripod closer to the dead man's black jeans, and the inside-out right pocket began to glow a dull rouge. I poked the material with my gloved finger and found smears of iridescent orange. "Don't believe I've ever gotten a red like that before," Vander mused. We spent an hour going over all of the clothing, including shoes and belt, and nothing else fluoresced. "Definitely two things there," Vander said as I turned on the lights. "Two different things fluorescing naturally. No dye stains involved except the one I used on the bucket." I picked up the phone and called the morgue. Fielding answered. "I need everything that was in the pockets of our unidentified man. It should be air-drying on a tray."
"That would be some foreign money, a cigar clipper, and a lighter."
"Yes." Lights off again, and we finished scanning the exterior of all the clothing, finding more of the odd pale hair.
"Is that coming off his head?" Vander asked, as my forceps entered the cool blue light, gently grabbing hairs and placing them inside an envelope.
"His head hair is dark and coarse," I replied. "So, no, this hair can't be his."
"Looks like cat hair. One of these long-haired types that I don't allow in the house anymore. Angora? Himalayan?"
"Rare. Not too many people have either one," I said.
"My wife loves cats," Vander went on. "She had this one named Creamsicle. Damn thing would look for my clothes and lie on them, and when I'd find them to get dressed, damn if they didn't look just like this."
"I guess it could be cat hair," I supposed.
"Too fine for dog hair, don't you think?"
"Not if it's something like a Skye Terrier. Long, straight, silky hair. Pale yellow. They can be tawny," I said. "Maybe the undercoat? I don't know."
"Maybe the guy's a breeder, or works with one," Vander suggested. "Aren't there long-hair rabbits, too?"
"Knock, knock,"
Fielding's voice sounded as he opened the door. He walked in, tray in hand, and we turned on the lights. "There are Angora rabbits," I said. "The ones the sweaters are made from."
"You look like you've been working out again," Vander said to Fielding. "You mean I haven't looked that way before?" Fielding asked.
Vander looked puzzled, as if he'd never noticed that Fielding was a body-sculpting fanatic. "We've picked up on some sort of residue in one of the pockets," I told Fielding. "It's the same pocket the money was in." Fielding removed the towel that covered the tray.